Maybe it's time to stop trying to change our politicians' minds and just change our politicians. That's what a few good women in Kentucky are up to, and we'll talk to one. Rubrics instead of grades? Alfie says no. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
From ForwardKentucky.com, from Gay Edelman. How do we get so many educators to run? It's called A Few Good Women, Kentucky.
Check it out, right? From, you know, so the piece is written in first person by Gay herself, but the question, how did we get so many educators to run? For what?
For what?
Right.
What are they running for?
So the issue here, though, and I've said this many times on this show, is that the problem with education policy is that we let politicians who have no freaking clue what to do set education policy.
Right.
Gay agreed with me in Kentucky.
But she did something about it.
But took it a step further instead of just whining like we do here at Busted Pencils,
right,
and formed A Few Good Women. Where actually, this is a really cool idea. She said, let's find retired educators who are out there, mostly women, and we'll hit that later in a second, and let's run for office and let's be the legislators who actually know what we're talking about when it comes to education policy.
Well, when you step back, it makes the most sense. These are people that have grown up literally in the classroom, and they've retired from the classroom, right, and now they can teach other people about the classroom.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
It makes total sense when you sit here and say, this is the type of participatory democracy we talk about in school when we tell all of our little kids, you know, you're in a democracy, you too can be president.
Mm-hmm.
However, we know that without a few million dollars, the reality of that's not really true.
Well, president of maybe their school council.
President
we'll
of school council. But you can be fully engaged, and you should be as a citizen participating. And Gay takes us to the furthest step, the best step, actually, which is we're going to run for office, particularly on issues that we know the most about. And so the other side, too, to this is so it sounds like probably a bunch of Democrats. They're like, no, we're taking on anybody and everybody who doesn't have the, at least according to A Few Good Women, the right education policies.
That's what I thought was interesting, too, is they didn't care what party line it was. Yeah. They just asked a question, are you for or against education?
Right.
And you could tell by the way they were voting, so they really didn't need to ask. And now people are scared of getting that question.
Hey, you know what? It's one of those things. Guess what? When finally politicians are either thinking, holy crap, I better have the right answer to that question, or, and if I don't, I'm going to get challenged. Now we're making serious headway in this. In fact, let's talk about this. One of the Gay herself, through this article, talks about that getting involved in this drew her deeper into looking at her own state senator's positions on education policy, and she found out, holy crap, this person doesn't know what they're talking about. Guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to run for that Senate seat and take on this person themselves. Mm-hmm. So not only did she also organize A Few Good Women to start this movement in Kentucky, but she herself is part of it and leading by example. You know what? We need a few more good women across this country.
From MarketWatch.com, canceling $1.4 trillion in student debt could have major benefits for the economy. Wiping away the $1.4 trillion in outstanding loan debt for the 44 million Americans who carry it could boost GDP by between $86 billion and $108 billion per year, on average, for the 10 years following the debt cancellation, according to a report published by Levy Economics Institute of Bard College.
Well, there you have it. The Levy Institute said so.
So it has to be true?
Canceling student loan debt, right?
Well,
go ahead.
Okay.
Throw out your critic. You know,
okay,
this is why you're here, is to keep me honest.
I truly believe 98% of all percentages are at least 86% made up.
I don't know if I can quantify that.
Right, exactly. I don't think they can either. But, I see why wiping out debt would boost the economy. If I didn't have to pay off my credit card loans and everything else and my house payment, I'd go buy more stuff.
Well, it speaks to this issue the longer we talk about it. I mean, we've had bankruptcy laws for the longest time, right? And
right.
The bankruptcy is this idea that, look, you're better off to clear the debt, start mm-hmm. over. And, in fact, our current president has used bankruptcy laws multiple times mm-hmm. to get himself back in financial shape. So if it's good for the president, why not me as a student loan carrier? Can't I have my, not all of my debt, because there's lots of other debts that I have, but my student loan debt, wipe it out. And guess what? And this is the issue here, is that by doing this, though, across the millions of students who have it, you increase the amount of spendable income now. So the $470+ a month right now that's going to some bank from me,
right,
could be $470 going directly into the economy. And so across the economy, across the country, across all those millions of debt carriers, what is that effect on the total economy? And this study says, hey, it's good. It would be really good.
Oh, it would be really good for the economy. But where do you draw that line?
Well, so the question then is so you let all these people, you know, run free and they don't learn any responsibility and things like that. I know there's always those issues there again. But the idea of canceling debt is something that we've always done, and we recognize that it is an economic booster in some mm-hmm. ways. And when we say it's good for one person, we should be asking, is it good for others? Here, the idea of students and the fact that most of the student loan debt, when you get deeper into this article, was accumulated here mostly in the last 20 years when colleges themselves were defunded by governments particularly, and therefore then driving up the costs and making students take out loans. And now there seems to be a possible reversal in the sense that more and more colleges are looking to drop tuition and even the whole idea of free tuition. Here you could have a group of people now saddled with debt when prior to them getting to their debt and now after their debt, college essentially was free. So now we're starting to talk about this from a quote, how fair is it that one group of people got penalized by a group of crappy legislators and people who think to defunding college is good? That's, you know, out there. Let me tell you, though, my point, give me that $460. It will not be going into an IRA. I guarantee you small businesses around Slecker and Busted Pencils will benefit greatly.
Time for Tim to rant. This is Someone Has to Say It.
Do we really need blue ribbon panels? Well, it's a good question, because in Wisconsin, we have just formed a blue ribbon panel to look at school funding across the state of Wisconsin. Why would you want to look at school funding across the state of Wisconsin? Well, as any teacher, parent, and child who happens to be in a public school knows, depends on where you live and the amount of money you actually get. So we have a, quote, school funding problem in Wisconsin. The solution? Talk to teachers, talk to parents, talk to kids. No, we form a blue ribbon panel of special politicians who will go out and hear testimony across the state from those most affected by what we already know exists, which is a funding inequity that absolutely discriminates across racial and socioeconomic borders. Let's be honest. There is not a single member of the panel that doesn't already know that Wisconsin public school funding is a criminal enterprise that maintains a stratified population of haves and have-nots. The panel, quote, is a sham. No teachers and no parents on the panel. They're only allowed to testify to the powerful, only to be dismissed as silly whiners. Structures matter. Inclusion matters. Here is exclusion working perfectly. Please, no more blue ribbon panels. She got into public education advocacy when her son made the choice to attend an aviation magnet and what she learned to be considered a failing school in the wrong part of town. She is also the founder of A Few Good Women, Kentucky. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Gay Adelman.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Okay, so you
We actually, this is really cool because you were just in our news a little bit earlier in the show because we featured this story, particularly about you, that actually you wrote in Forward Kentucky, How Did We Get So Many Educators to Run? And we read through this and this is awesome. My news person, Bonnie, we had a great time talking about the story because what's awesome here is the idea that let's get educators to run. I mean, so what pushed you into this position?
Well, as you mentioned in your intro, my son attended a school. He just recently graduated from a school that was labeled a failing school. It was persistently low achieving. In Kentucky, we have a cohort of priority schools, and his school was one of the first schools to go into priority status. And yet my son got a 32 on his ACT, and he's now at the U.S. Naval Academy. So to listen to lawmakers continue to berate the staff and the students at that school and label them a failure, there was some kind of disconnect, and it really ate at me to the point where I started speaking at board meetings and even talking to state legislators to help them try to really understand what's going on in public education.
So and so the frustration, like any parent, here we are, public education, we're frustrated, we're looking at this, and we're complaining, and some people say, look, busted pencils, all you do is complain. When are you going to actually do something about it? And this, though, is what I love about your story, because after you decided to voice your concerns, you did more than voice your concerns. Talk about a few good women, Kentucky, or if you want to start before that, that's fine, too.
Well, what we were seeing is that lawmakers had oftentimes never even set foot in our public schools. They were making laws based on stereotypes and misconceptions. And for the mainstream student, that's okay. You know, kids are going to be okay even if there's bad laws forcing them to take too many tests or this or that. But at my son's school, where we were 85 to 90% free and reduced lunch, high poverty, high special needs, high trauma, urban part of town, I was just seeing that the unintended consequences of bad laws really played out in a magnified way in schools like my son's. And so I took it upon myself to talk with other teachers because we were without a principal at the time. And then I started trying to communicate the things that I learned from those teachers and administrators, and even started paying attention to what was going on across the country and realized that this is part of a national playbook. You know, all of the dots connected for me and made it possible for me to organize with other parents and start a Facebook page. And that's really what it started with, was a Facebook page. We had 5,000 followers within, you know, just a month or so. There was clearly a need, an untapped way of communicating with our leaders about what's really going on and organizing our thoughts in a way that helped them write better laws. But really, when it came to the A Few Good Women in Kentucky, it really came about because we realized that these lawmakers that are making these laws have very little understanding of what's truly going on in public education, and who knows better about what's going on in our public schools and what the true solutions are than our teachers. And retired teachers in particular have the time on their hands to maybe get involved in running for office. And so, you know, being that most teachers are female, it's a highly female-dominated profession, we just kind of looked at each other and said, we need a few good women. And that stuck, and we created a webpage, and we started going around and trying to recruit retired teachers. And active teachers came forward, strong public education advocates came forward, we got some school board members that are running. It's really important that people who understand public education are involved in the making of these laws, and that's really the impetus behind the group that we created. But also it's important to note that in Kentucky, we just passed our first charter school bill in 2017, and the Kochs actually paid to lobby in our state for the first time last year.
That'd be the Koch
House.
Just one, the Koch brothers, who notoriously fund they fund the defunding of public schools, huh?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, and their legislative arm called ALEC. We saw Americans for Prosperity, which is one of their so-called, we call them AstroTurf groups, but they like to pretend like they're grassroots, just like groups like ours. And so we saw a huge influx of these operatives in our state for the first time last year, and we passed our charter school bill for the first time. So all of these threats were coming together as a perfect storm, and we tried to mobilize fast enough to inform our legislators why these bills were bad, and it was cookie cutter bills. And we're Kentucky. We started education reform 30 years ago. We had CARA, Kentucky Education Reform Act, and we are nationally renowned for our education reform and the strides we made being such a poor state to make so many leaps and bounds forward, and to just throw the baby out with the bathwater and introduce an ALEC bill that, you know, was not what was, that drew out all the progress that we had made over the last 27 years was not the right thing to do. So we tried to inform our legislators. They didn't get it. The bill passed anyway. And so over the break, we said, you know, anybody who voted for this charter school bill, we're going to have somebody run against them. Nobody should run unopposed in the next election. And so that's where it all kind of took off.
That's the part I love this, because, again, we criticize the lawmakers for not understanding the realities of the classroom and making policy. And some of that is because we know they're funded by nefarious groups like the Koch, Americans for Prosperity and stuff like that. But, you know, a few good women, Kentucky, with, it seems like you said, help from Save Our Schools Kentucky, Kentucky Initiative, indivisible district, but you guys said, let's get retired teachers at first, and more than create like a group that communicates, we're going to become legislators. We're going to be the legislators. And in fact, you are now, I loved how you ended that last part, because you guys are now at the point of saying, look, if you're on the wrong side of public education, we're coming after you.
Absolutely. You can't have it both ways. The funding follows the child, as you know, and we cannot afford to have any more money leaving our schools right now. So you can't say that you're pro-public education and also have voted for a charter school. You're either with us or you're against us. And this year we're headed into our finance. Every other year is a budget year, and this is our budget year, and we've got a pension crisis looming. We've got a budget crisis. For them to figure out how to fund the charter schools is making them look really, really foolish right now. So we're actually seeing a lot of our legislators backpedal on the bill that they passed last year. We're hoping that we can actually repeal the bill completely. And that's where I think things are so exciting in Kentucky, because we know that this is a national threat that's been happening for decades. It's finally in Kentucky. Kentuckians are waking up fast enough that I think we can actually stop it and reverse this national trend. And my hope is that so however goes Kentucky, so goes the country, and we can be that domino that flips everything back the other way.
We are speaking with activist, founder of A Few Good Women, Gay Adelman, on 1510 AM Resistance Radio, Busted Pencils. When we get back, though, we're going to explore maybe a little bit about the bourbon in Kentucky, but more so, let's talk more, Gay, about how you're actually going to unseat these people.
Sounds great.
Gay, I mean, what are the prospects?
Well, I think they're good.
Because you were saying when right before we left, you said, so goes Kentucky, hopefully so goes the nation. I want to know where so goes Kentucky.
Well, if we can get our house back, we have the potential to undo a lot of the bad legislation. Right now, our session runs through early April, I believe, and there's so much chaos in our House and our Senate, especially in our House, that if we can just get them to not do any more damage this year, and then in November we take back the House and get a few more seats in the Senate as well, maybe even take back the Senate, we can stop and minimize the damage that our governor is doing, and then in 2019 unseat him as well. So, you know, the blue wave is here. We are. People are not happy about our governor and the legislation that passed last year. They passed 7 bills the first week of session right after the Kochs had gotten involved. We passed a right-to-work bill, paycheck protection bill, 2 pro-life bills, all within the first week and all within emergency clause, so they went into effect right away. And so that was the beginning of the session. They also shortened the review period from 3 days to 1, so they could actually pass a bill a day after it was introduced. It was just disgusting, and the citizens were paying attention and more frustrated and disgusted with the laws that they saw come out of session last year. So as we started into this session, people were engaged and paying attention and calling their legislators. We've got people down at the Capitol every day standing in the hallways when legislators are on their way to chamber, having to read our signs and be aware that we are, you know, engaged. And we've got people calling the legislative line and making their appointments and sending opinion letters. And another great thing about having so many people running for office, too, is that we get to be part of the conversation all the way up through November. When these legislators run unopposed, their ideas run unopposed and unchallenged. And it's easy for people to just sit and hear that one side of the story and say, oh, yeah, choice. What's wrong with choice? That sounds good. Yeah, we need.
Right.
People need to be able to take their money where, you know, it's a logical story until you hear both sides. So just simply having these educators in these positions where they're challenging and sitting at town halls and part of the dialogue all the way through, I think is going to help really reshape what we're able to accomplish this session. And I really, truly believe that a lot of them will win.
Well, this is why I really wanted to tell this story on Busted Pencils for more people to hear about what you're actually doing in Kentucky, because in reality, this is the solution. If we're going to make any type of significant moves against education reform as we know it, the idea that we're going to rely on the current political status quo to either, quote, change their minds or make a shift in this or stop accepting money, it's just not going to happen. And so moving into and taking on truly your own civic responsibility and stepping up and running for office, it's also just a wonderful lesson for kids. So when we talk about education, this other thing is, does any of this filter down to the students to hear about what's happening from a civic education standpoint, that there are people in Kentucky that are saying, this is how it's done. You want to be participatory government? It's not about getting 100 questions right. It's about truly participating and being a citizen. Any effects in the classroom?
That is a really great question. We have a Bill Watch club, a Bill club called Women on Watch that we just started at the beginning of the session. And last night was, it's every Monday night, and we actually had a student, a seventh grader, who had shadowed a senator come on as one of our panelists. And so it was really great to listen to her talk about what bills she saw come out of the Judiciary Committee. And she even was able to chime in on some of the other bills that we were discussing. So, yes, I will say that it's trickling down to the classroom level. We want to see more of that. We want to get more students involved in talking to the legislators directly to help them understand in first person what's truly going on when they may pass a bill that's an unfunded mandate. We've seen a lot of those lately where they think they can piecemeal fix what's wrong with education by just putting more Band-Aids on. And we have an abstinence bill that's going through our legislation right now, and we don't even have comprehensive sex education. So for them to introduce a bill that says we must teach abstinence really becomes an abstinence-only bill.
Right.
And unfortunately, what happens with abstinence education is that it becomes a great deal of shaming, especially to women. Women are the ones that are expected to say yes or no and dress appropriately and those types of things. And so it manifests itself in exercises such as sticky tape that the female student goes around the classroom sticking to her classmate's arms. And then by the time it gets back to her, the teacher says, now put that back on your arm. And she says, see, it won't stick because you've had so many partners. Your relationship will never be found. And then this poor girl who testified in the Senate Education Committee hearing about this type of sex, you know, abstinence training, had unfortunately just been raped previously. And so it had labeled her as unworthy of a husband when it wasn't even her own doing. She had no control over that choice. So we really just have to educate lawmakers, especially when they happen to be mostly white men who have never walked around in a female body or have the same reproductive parts that we do, to be making these laws. We've got to get more women and more first-person perspective stories told to these lawmakers if they're going to be making these laws. So,
well, I mean, geez, you just this whole idea, abstinence only, and I know all the research on it is horrendous, but your example is horrifying to put that out there like that. That's a real life issue. And now we come back to, as you just said, a bunch of white men who've never stepped foot inside a classroom, who don't understand what it's like to be a seventh grade student, girl, female, the idea that students are now getting engaged, informing them, educators getting engaged. What if I'm in Wisconsin? Holy crap, I am. And I want to form a Few Good Women Wisconsin. How would we, and how would we go about that? Or the other question is, how the heck do we get the rest of the country to follow your lead?
Well, the filing deadline created that sense of urgency for us. January 30th was the filing deadline. And as we worked with different groups around town that had specific concerns about lawmakers that had introduced or passed egregious bills against their causes, you know, we kind of cross-referenced our notes and said, you know, this group said these three have to go or these nine have to go. We made our list of those who voted for charter schools and specifically targeted them and found educators in their district. And, you know, social media is amazing for organizing. And, you know, people stepped up. And we didn't fill every single seat with a challenger, unfortunately. You know, time did run out. But we did manage to get 40 educators, as I mentioned. And I am not an educator. I'm just an angry mom. But I looked at my Senate.
I was gonna say, hold on, because I want you like, wait a minute, because we're gonna come to that. Because not only, first of all, don't call yourself only an angry mom, okay? Angry moms are the ones who actually get crap done. So being only an angry mom actually is, you know, not giving yourself credit. But
no,
so 40 educators running, and then this idea here as we look at the piece in Forward Kentucky, though, where you say you yourself looked at your local state senator and went, holy crap, they're on the wrong side of these issues. Well, I guess I'm one of those few good women in Kentucky, and you now are running for state senate in Kentucky yourself.
I am, District 36. I realized that she had voted against public education by her pro-charter vote as well, and if I was going to talk the talk, I needed to walk the walk, and I filed to run just a week or so before the deadline. I do now have a primary challenger as well, but that person also does not have any first-hand experience in public school. Her son also attended a private school. We've got threats from scholarship tax credits here this year, and so the Catholic movement is really pushing those. So I feel like not being tied to the Catholic school like my opponents are, I have the freedom to speak out and against any threats to our public schools that might be imposed by the private schools and by the Catholic schools. I also am not employed. I'm self-employed, I should say. And since I am self-employed, I pretty much am not employed right now because I haven't been able to bill hours for quite some time, but that's a separate story. But I'm not emboldened to an employer that might want to stifle my freedom of speech. My primary opponent is employed by one of the largest employers here, and the founder of her organization happens to be our former school board chair, who we, when we first started getting vocal and realized that he was pro-business pro-privatization, we organized and pushed to get him removed and also kept out another highly funded Coke operative and really kind of took back our local school board. So that is also where this movement really began, is getting control at the school board level. Then once we got the school board members who were responsive to the voters instead of to the outside interests, we were able to get rid of our superintendent who had come from Wake County, North Carolina, where the Kochs were very heavily involved, and replaced. In fact, our permanent superintendent was just named yesterday, and he is homegrown. He's been in our district for 20-some-odd years. He knows our challenges. He knows our history, and he can hit the ground running and really truly understand from the inside what it's going to take to fix our schools. So there are huge accomplishments happening all over our state and all over our our district. Our district is the 28th largest district in the country and the largest in the state. We have over 101,000 students. So clearly, this is monumental for Kentucky.
Well, she is more, way more than just an angry mom. She is the founder of A Few Good Women Kentucky. She is Gay Adelman, and she is also running for the state senate in Kentucky. Gay, thanks for busting pencils with us today.
Absolutely. If I could invite you to visit afewgoodwomenky.org and also adelmanforky.com, we need reinforcements in Kentucky. We appreciate it.
We will do that. Thank you, Gay.
You bet. Thank you.
This is Busted Pencils on 1510 AM Resistance Radio from Milwaukee Teachers Education Association, teaching all children.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
She is assistant professor in the College of Arts and Sciences at Trinity Washington University in Washington, D.C. She is one badass teacher, and she is one of the most awesome guests we have here on Busted Pencils. Welcome back, Dr. Denisha Jones.
Thanks, Tim. I'm glad to be back. You guys are my favorite radio show podcast.
Hey, you name a podcast, radio show. That's right. It's on the radio. It's on podcast. It's on the internet. You want to bust pencils, you can find it. It's out there somewhere. So, Denisha, though, you're back on the Defending the Early Years blog. Okay, you've got your own Teacher Talks, Denisha Jones, and I'm going through this, and you've got your new blog. It's been out there a few days now. This is how you protect childhood. Now, I just want to first set this up, that you put out there by setting up this blog by saying that, you know, you were invited to give a talk, and you pretty much say, look, we've screwed up everything up to this point. Let's at least protect childhood. What did we screw up?
Well, I was asked to write an opening for a journal by a guy named Helg, and the journal was looking at global creeping in germ in early child education. So they asked me to write an intro. And so my intro was titled, When All Else Fails, We Need to Protect Childhood. Because in essence, we failed, you know, Tim, we failed to stop all this stuff. Privatization has been happening since No Child Left Behind, 20 years of charter schools and vouchers and all this, and it's not going away. We've got Trump and Betsy DeVos making it worse. So, and I thought, you know, when you realize you failed and you accept failure as what's happened, then you're willing to try harder. But if you keep thinking, oh, we're doing okay, then you don't recognize that you actually need to try something different. So my talk was saying, look, we failed to stop this, and we need to come up with a new game plan. And that game plan needs to be plain and simple. We're here to protect childhood. And if we can center all of our work on that, then we might have a chance to win this.
Yeah, and then it goes a little bit further, though, because you talk about this experience or this situation blog in Florida, where in Florida, you know, they decide to use this, quote, iReady. So, Denisha, I'm ready to talk about iReady. With five-year-olds, though, enforcing five-year-olds to do up to 90 minutes of extra work on this iReady programming for rewards, and how this didn't go over so well with your protecting childhood position.
Yeah, so a friend of mine, Sandy Senoff, tagged me in a post there, and I'm reading it. A parent is livid. She just moved to Florida, and she's livid about this letter saying, you know, your kid needs to do 90. We don't have enough time in school, first of all. So your kid needs to do 90 minutes of iReady a week at home, and they'll be rewarded when they come to school by getting extra trip into the prize box. You know, it's just screaming carrot stick bribery inappropriateness. And so I'm reading through the comments, and what really struck me so hard was how many people said, well, what's the big deal? My kid likes iReady. And so my comment was, you know, kid, it doesn't matter whether your kid likes it or not. You know, kids might like licking cement, but we don't let them lick cement because we know it's not good for them, right? You're invading parents' private time at home with your children after they've been in school for 6 to 8 hours a day to do more work on a computer in the name of what? Of iReady. So Sandy published a blog about the parent's response. The parent was livid and wrote a great letter, and I read it. I said, you know, this is how you protect childhood. It's easy to say we should all protect childhood, but what does it look like? It looks like two parents saying, heck no, you're not bribing me or my child into doing more in the name of iReady.
Well, and I think that blog from the parent, too, and we'll make a link to this on the Busted Pencils website, but for now, it's the Opt Out Florida Network, where these parents really laid into the school district about saying, look, you know, and restating some of the things you said about, you know, they've been in school for 7 hours, they've been learning to cooperate, they've been learning to sit still. I'm sorry, but they're not going to spend another 90 minutes doing iReady because it's inappropriate. And I recommend the listener to check this out. It's the Opt Out Florida Network. Again, we'll have a link to that on the Busted Pencils website, because boy, these parents laid it out beautifully. And so, but then this takes us to the next stage, where you then say, you know what though, let's put together a pledge to protect childhood.
Yeah, this was such a good example. You're right. And that letter was so well written. It was so detailed. It clearly expressed everything that I was thinking when I read about this. And so, yeah, I just came up with a simple pledge that we can take. And we can say we're going to pledge to protect childhood. Things we're going to say no to. I started in the beginning, no to developmentally inappropriate assessments. If you do early childhood, you know what developmentally appropriate is for young children. And these assessments, these computerized assessments, are not. Saying no to excessive screen time. Look, our kids don't need to be any more connected to the computer than they already are. I teach college students, and I can't get them to put away their phones for minutes because they're so addicted, right?
Right.
Saying no to excessive, rigorous academic instruction. Little kids don't need academic instruction. They need play. They need the freedom to learn. They need emergent curriculum. They need project-based learning. They need to ask questions and answer questions. And then things that we want to demand, right? We demand free play, demand authentic assessments, and demand opportunities for kids to score. So I want it to be a balance, because I think moving forward, we have to say no to things, but we also have to create what we want. We have to say what we want, name it, imagine it, create it, and put it out there, right? We can't just be the party of no, 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 no. It's time to focus on what, and we know what's good for children, and we just got to get it out there.
Right. So, I really like the pledge. In fact, before we end this segment, you're going to give me the pledge. I'm going to do the pledge, and then we're going to ask all Busted Pencils listeners to take this pledge too. But I like how you state first, though, about what it is that's unacceptable, but then move it into here's what we want, because you're right. Too often we are spending time criticizing legitimately, but then never following through with what we want. And so this pledge to protect childhood is a combination of here's what we're not going to tolerate and here's what we expect. And so, Denisha, I'm going to right now be that one first person to publicly take the pledge from you, but I want you, Denisha Jones, from Defending the Early Years, to give me that pledge, and I will repeat after you.
All right. You ready?
I'm ready, Denisha.
Okay. I pledge to protect childhood.
I pledge to protect childhood.
I pledge to say no to developmentally inappropriate assessments.
I pledge to say no to developmentally inappropriate assessments.
I pledge to say no to excessive screen time.
I pledge to say no to excessive screen time.
I pledge to say no to excessive rigorous academic instruction.
I pledge to say no to excessive rigorous academic instruction.
I demand free play as the curriculum for all children.
I demand free play as the curriculum for all children.
I demand natural, authentic assessments conducted by classroom teachers.
I demand natural, authentic assessments conducted by classroom teachers.
I demand opportunities for all children to explore nature and create with their imagination.
I demand opportunities for all children to explore nature and create with their imagination.
I pledge to protect childhood.
I pledge to protect childhood.
Woo-hoo, Tim.
Woo-hoo. You know what? The only thing I would add to that, Denisha?
Mm-hmm.
I pledge to bust pencils.
Oh, you're right. All right. If I ever do another version, I'll have to think of that, how I can add the best of pencils.
Well, Denisha Jones, as we say, though, every time you're on, though, you do bust pencils. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Tim. Anytime. Love the work. Keep up the fight.
You keep it up too, Denisha, and keep defending those early years, and let's get this pledge out there. This is 1510 AM Resistance Radio.
Amy Bahena was on a few weeks ago stressing the importance of qualified licensed educators in our schools. You can hear the podcast at bustedpencils.com. Here's Amy's take on that famous Alfie Cohn question, what are the schools our children deserve?
The schools our children deserve are ones that are fully staffed and fully funded, providing them opportunities to dream and to grow and to explore in age-appropriate, non-standardized ways, ones that help them to feel comfortable and safe and learn to be a fellow inhabitant of this planet, a fellow human being, and really make their own way in this complex, complex world that we call home. Those are the schools our children deserve.
From Alfie's famous question to Alfie himself.
You are entering Cone Zone on Busted Pencils.
Alfie Cone, we're not going to give grades anymore because we are moving into a more holistic way of communicating to students their accomplishments. We're using rubrics.
Not so fast, say I.
Okay.
First of all, too often rubrics are just used to yield grades. So you get the worst of both worlds, as opposed to finding truly authentic assessment that is an alternative to grades. And let's pause here just for a moment to review why we're moving away, hopefully, from grades, and not just juicing them up with the latest fad of calling them standards-based grades or something.
Okay.
The research shows that grades have three robust effects. First, they lead kids to become less interested in the learning itself, whatever the topic was or the whole field. Every study I've been able to find that has looked at intrinsic motivation in graded and non-graded conditions has found that grades kill interest in learning. The second effect is that grades lead kids to try to pick the easiest possible task, not because they're lazy, but because they're rational. And the third effect is that grades lead kids to think in a more superficial fashion. They're less focused on understanding the idea and more focused on what do I have to do in order to get the higher grade. And let me emphasize this. All of this applies, these three effects, whether kids get good grades or bad grades. The relevant distinction is not between getting an A and getting a C. The relevant distinction is between kids who are trying to get good report cards because that's what they're being pressured to do, and those lucky enough to go to schools that don't use grades at all. Okay, now the important thing to realize is not only that we have to get rid of them, not merely use rubrics to produce them, but we have to understand that those same effects are actually multiplied when you spend even more time evaluating kids on more criteria in more subjects. So part of the problem is a larger body of research showing that the more you get kids focused on how well they're doing in school, the less they tend to be engaged with what they're doing in school. They're focused on levels of achievement, not layers of understanding. And rubrics focus kids' attention even more fixedly on how well they're doing now with respect to more different criteria. And the more they're focused, now they're not saying, to take a very concrete example, how can I write a story that will grab the attention of my reader? They're saying, is this a four? And is it a four on all the segmented parts on or topic organization and use of evidence and all of that? The more you get kids trying to get good rubric scores, the more you've lost them as learners. And what's really amazing is the number of teachers who understandably hate standardized tests but think nothing of smuggling standardization in through the back door, which is precisely what rubrics do.
Yeah, that reminds me, in fact, when I wrote for Huffington Post, I wrote a piece about my son who doing a writing assignment, started off his, what was supposed to be, according to the rubric, an exciting story. He started it off with woo-hoo, and we got called to the teacher, and she said, according to the rubric, this is not an opening sentence. He would, and you know, it's like, and so it proves your point, though. Here he was trying to go with the idea of an exciting story and right. using woo-hoo, but the rubric said you don't do that.
Well, some teachers and consultants will respond, well, that was just a stupid rubric. All we have to do is get good rubrics, just improve the quality. And I think that's a very seductive but ultimately very dangerous position, because I think the problem is not with the type of rubric and the particulars of what it calls a 4 or a 3. The problem is with the very idea of rubrics, which are based on two things. First, assuming that you can break something into its component rubricizable parts, a very behavioristic, mechanistic notion. And second, that you can then quantify success at each of those little bitty parts. So it's about reductivism, and it's about the behaviorist tendency to assume that you can measure rather than just assess things. And that's those two. The more you know about learning, the more you know that those are two very serious mistakes. And they will become the tail that wags the dog in this classroom. Because if you have to reduce things to a rubric, then you will start teaching the kind of stuff that is reducible to a rubric.
I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Thanks for Busting Pencils.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.